This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Craig Monson. He's Professor Emeritus of Music at Washington University. He's author of the new book, Habitual Offenders, A True Tale of Nuns, Prostitutes, and Murderers in 17th Century Italy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte.
So this is really a fascinating book. It's a combination of carefully researched Italian history and a kind of true crime genre. This is a story about two prostitutes who became nuns, who were then murdered in Bologna in 1644. How on earth did you come across this story?
Well, about 30 years ago, when I was still a musicologist and a music historian, I stumbled over the fact that convents were a center of musical activity in the 16th to 18th centuries. So I began to explore archives. And one of the things one learns as an archivist is not to be limited to a specific subject. For one thing, you might go nuts if you were just constantly turning the pages, finding nothing for day after day, which can be a reality. So I always tried to be sensitive or interested in non-musical things as well as musical things. And in 1989, I ran across this reference in a chronicle or diary to these two reformed prostitute nuns that had fled the convent. Then, 15 months later, their bodies were discovered buried in a wine cellar with the garrote still around their neck. And that was too interesting not to note in my notebook, because, of course, this was in the era before computers. You brought a notebook and a pencil to an archive rather than a computer. And so after that, I kept looking for traces of these women, as I was looking for traces of musical activity in convents as well. And ironically, it wasn't until about 25 years later, when I had access to computers and the internet, that I Googled the name of one of the alleged perpetrators of the crime and found an obscure, very academic history of papal politics that happened to mention this and give a reference to the transcript of the investigation. So I went off to Rome, put in the call number, and they brought out this massive tome that was 8 inches thick with 2,200 pages.
There's a picture of it in the book, which is amazing. It's
right.
Gigantic.
Yeah. And it contained all sorts of things. And that was one of the things that made it so interesting. Not only the word-for-word transcription of the questions and the answers, but also love letters that were found in one of the nuns' cells, for example. Or it also included the expense list of the brother of one of the alleged perpetrators who came from the family home in the north of Italy to try to help his brother. And it was possible to reconstruct the realities of having a relative confined to prison. Because, of course, if you were in prison, you had to pay your own expenses. So one can track how this relative provided for him and tried to make his life better.
One of the things that is so interesting is that there's a kind of like prostitute to convent pipeline. I mean, when you get too old to practice your trade as prostitute, then you go into the convent.
Right. If you've managed to save money, because of course it wasn't free. The dowry was about 1/5 of what you would have had to pay at a top tier convent. But still, you had to save your money.
Dowry, just like a marriage.
Right. And the dowry, what you needed to provide a dowry in order to pay your living expenses once you'd gone behind the wall. And of course, it turns out that these two women had been extremely successful. And once they got in the convent, they were even more successful because they started a laundry business that attracted people from all over town. And as one other disgruntled nun said of one of them, she lived like a princess.
Well, it does bring up that phrase, if this is poverty, give me chastity. I mean, they lived very well. They had their business. They had suitors, or whatever you want to call them, who were bringing them
gentlemen
jewels.
Callers.
Yeah, gentlemen callers, yeah. Bringing them lavish gifts.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it was a much more primitive lifestyle than in the top-tier convents, which were like lavish sorority houses, really, in some ways. It was much more confining, controlled, though it's interesting that the women themselves were totally different than the women in the upscale convents. These were women, after all, who had seen men with their pants down, and both clerics and secular men. And so they treated them rather differently than women elsewhere. This is the only convent in which I've found references to when they're visited by male clerics, they should not use foul language and profanity to each other.
Now, was the entire convent so-called reformed prostitutes?
Yes. In some convents of, they were in Italy, they're called convertite, converted prostitutes. In some convents of convertite, there were also sections for what were called malmaritate, women who were badly married, i.e. had abusive husbands. But there was always a bit of a difficulty in bringing the two together. In some cases, the bishops would feel that the malmaritate were secularizing the reformed prostitutes. In other places, they thought the reformed prostitutes were corrupting the wives, so it could be a problem.
Who were these two women? What do we know about them, the two who ended up being murdered?
Right. Well, one of the real challenges was that these two women, who should be the heroes or heroines of the book, are the most elusive characters in it, because they disappear on page one and then they're found murdered. So the only way one can get to know them is through what the documents tell us and what the other nuns chose to say about them or to fabricate about them. So it's to some extent, I had to try to recreate their lives in relation to other women in the city of Bologna who were in the same situation. So it's about complex, difficult marriages, poverty, female poverty, the challenges of getting by, for example, if your husband either dies or deserts you, and then you have to make ends meet as best you can. So one could track down a few biographical details, like when they were born. That would be listed in the baptismal records of the city. But a lot of it depends on what was discoverable through the testimony both of people who knew them, for example, the mother and sister of one of the two nuns, but especially of the other nuns. And there, of course, it's as interesting to try to tell what was true from what was imagined or fabricated by the other sisters.
One thing we know for sure was that one of them was 6 feet tall, with beautiful ivory pale skin and bright red hair.
Yes, this woman must have been such a head-turner because, I mean, a woman that is almost 6 feet tall in 1644 with bright red hair, she had beautiful long fingers. People talked about her beautiful long fingers and this pale skin. But then, of course, she also had this distinguishing feature of a scar running down her left cheek from under her ear to under her chin, and this was probably a work-related injury because it was very common for prostitutes to be slashed as a form of vengeance. So there you have this beautiful woman with this one imperfection. Even after she had entered the convent and was wearing a wimple, you could still see it.
And the other was shorter and sort of more heavy set, and with a beautiful smile that even her corpse lit up the room.
Right. I mean, they're like opposites. The older one, who was 40, Silveria Caterina, was only 5 feet tall, and somebody described her as round like a plum, which means she was overweight. She had chestnut hair, though it was falling out, but she had a perfect set of even white teeth. And if you think about the year 1644, the number of people who had good teeth was a rarity. And everyone talked about this smile that that lit up the room, as it were.
We're talking to Craig Monson about his book, Habitual Offenders. Now, when these nuns first disappeared, and their bodies weren't discovered, as you said, right away, what was the response when they went missing?
Well, there was an immediate investigation by the archiepiscopal hierarchy. They sent someone to the convent to question the nuns. And usually there's a particular way of doing that, beginning with the most senior nuns and interviewing every single one of them. Well, there were 128 women in this convent, so they ended up only choosing to interview the ones that supposedly might know the most about the missing nuns. But they seem to have been most interested in trying to get the nuns that were still at the convent to incriminate each other. So the investigation basically went nowhere. And after a month, it was abandoned.
Now, this was big news in Bologna at that moment. These two nuns had disappeared. They'd run away. They were kind of locked in, but they found a way to get out. How did news travel in those days? I mean, obviously, they didn't have the internet.
Well, they had the 16th and 17th century equivalent, which was called la voce pubblica, the public voice, the gossip circuit.
Yeah.
I mean, and the interesting thing about this story is everybody else in town but the clergy knew what had happened. They knew where they were hiding out, and before long, the rumor started going around that they had been murdered. But it was another year and 3 months before the bodies were discovered, and that's when the clergy finally retook up the investigation, and by interviewing all these people, gradually managed to piece things together.
Now, today, an investigation like that would be handled by the police.
Right.
Was the clergy, did it have its own police? How did that
well,
work?
Well, see, because Bologna, the city of Bologna, was part of the Papal States, there it was ecclesiastically governed. But it's interesting, there were two investigative bodies. There was the archbishop and his circle, but there was also a secular body that was also headed by a cardinal appointed by Rome. And in the early stages of this case, both bodies were investigating independently and were essentially in a kind of rivalry with each other. And so you can imagine, you know, today the trouble we have with the FBI not cooperating with local entities. Well, it was the same problem here until the Pope finally said, look, the archiepiscopal curia will be in charge and you have to share whether you want to or not.
Very interesting. So how were these women murdered? Where were their bodies found and what happened next?
Well, after 15 months, a woman who had been off living in Florence with her son, who had fled to Florence after his enemies attempted to shoot him on the streets in Bologna, came back to her house, which had been largely standing empty. And they moved back in. She sent the 13-year-old German servant to clean out the wine cellar. He went in. There was a horrible stench. He got curious, removed some bundles, and discovered that the floor had been broken up and the soil was mounded suspiciously. And despite the fact that he was choking on the stench, he began to dig with his hands and before long came to the conclusion that this was a grave. So then he went down to the authorities. The authorities came down and began digging and discovered the bodies, which, interestingly enough, were remarkably preserved. They were not skeletons. They were more like mummies because the bodies had been covered with lime, which, as it turns out, may to some extent control the smell, but it doesn't destroy the bodies. It tends to preserve them.
And so here was this redhead.
Right, with this sort of halo of red hair standing out against the white of the quicklime that had been poured around her.
This was an era before forensic science.
Right.
How was the investigation conducted?
Well, the interesting thing is that in order to convict someone in this period, you needed eyewitness testimony of two witnesses. So
of the murder itself?
Of the whatever the crime is. And in the absence of that, in order to convict, you needed a confession. So what happens in this case, of course, it's interesting to see that the alleged perpetrators seem to go out of their way to do everything when no one is there to see them, or else they bump them off afterwards. A few of the witnesses were actually disappeared mysteriously. So what the prosecutors have to do is build a strong enough case that they convince the Curia in Rome to allow them to torture the alleged perpetrators and get them to, and that's the way they get a confession. Now, if they torture someone and the person doesn't confess, they often have no excuse or no alternative but to let them go. So in this case, it's all a challenge to build a case that is strong enough that they ultimately could convince Rome to allow them to torture.
Which is what happened.
Which is what happens. There are basically three men who are accused. One is simply framed by the Pope as a way of trying to get back at Cardinal Antonio Barberini. That man is so smart that he tends to outwit the prosecutor whenever he's questioning him. And finally, they don't know what to do with him, so they kind of exile him to a city on the Italian coast until everyone finally makes nice with everyone else, and roughly 10 years later, the Pope lets him come back to Rome, lets him off. One of the other men is tortured and doesn't say a word except to insult the people that are torturing him, and he eventually dies while he is being tortured. The third one is tortured but doesn't confess, so basically he's the last man standing and is released and goes home to his family in time for Christmas in 1646.
Now, from the extensive records of the investigation in this gigantic book that you read all 2,000 pages of in 17th century Italian...
And Latin.
Yeah, writing in Latin. Did you come to a conclusion about what happened?
Well, to me, that was one of the most interesting things, is that it is not clear, entirely clear. And it may be partly that I'm now a retired academic, no longer teaching, but I was constantly thinking how fun this would be to teach, because it is open-ended. We know that the nuns are murdered. We have a good idea about who did it. I thought that it would be fun to have students rewrite the ending, to decide who did what to whom and justify it on the basis of the evidence. It's very clear about some of the most important details, but the nitty-gritty of actually how the murder happened, we don't know.
But what do you think was the motive?
I think there were several motives. I mean, it's interesting that you have two younger men. Each of them is 10 years younger than his nun innamorata.
So these are dudes in love with nuns.
Yes. There's a priest, a prominent priest, and then there's this 20-year-old mercenary soldier who was another head-turner, apparently. And I think the priest had a very complex relationship with the round, like a plum nun with the beautiful teeth, and I don't think she was entirely convinced by him, but she allowed herself to be convinced to flee the convent. So there was a romantic aspect, but there was also the fact that they had amassed this large quantity of silver, clothing, and furniture, which they smuggled out of the convent before they left. And I think the less scrupulous men had their eyes on their property. And once the women were finished off, the property was divided up amongst these various villains. So I think that's the main two reasons. It's also probable that in the case of the tall, glamorous redhead, she may have been more in love with the 20-year-old than he was with her, and it happens that his brother was a powerful colonel in the papal army and may have decided he didn't want his brother hanging around with his escaped nun, which was, as someone would say, gallows business. And so it may very well have been this older brother who had the nuns done in.
So all of this is a story, an amazing story. One can imagine the movie.
Or I think it would actually make a better PBS series, because it tends to work as a series of episodes, and there are characters who appear, loom large, and then disappear. And a lot of them are wonderful characters. I mean, most of the people in this book are not great men. Cardinals, popes, they may be pulling the strings, but the people who are actually involved are prostitutes, booksellers, handmaidens, servants, the people we tend not to hear so much. And it's actually fun to think about who could play the different characters.
You think about
that. Oh, yeah, then there's one. The Mother Superior, or the abbess in the convent, who is a woman who has very firm opinions. I think that the woman on Grantchester, the housekeeper on the series Grantchester, would be a great choice for her, for example.
Of course, all of this is going to be in British English, no doubt.
No, it would really needs to be the opposite, in fact.
Are you going to do it in, in Italy? Would you try to get a...
Well, I mean, the problem with this sort of thing, of course, is the costume dramas are so hard to fund.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this one takes place chiefly in dark, dank chambers, you know, either in convents or in prisons with, you know, cityscapes in cities like Rome or Bologna that one might be able to get at some way as well.
Now, has this story remained part of Bologna mythology? Is it something that people know about there?
No, it did until the early 1700s. And then essentially once everybody who remembered the story had died, it disappeared. Interestingly enough, Stendhal rediscovered it in the 19th century. And in Stendhal's unpublished works, he wrote those kind of Italian romances that he did publish. There is one called Le Monache di Bologna, and that still exists in his nachlass, in his unpublished papers, but it never found its way into print.
Now, there's something, I mean, besides the crazy, interesting true crime story, there's a lot to think about when you look at, I mean, who in Santa Fe today is thinking about 17th century Italy and what life was like there? But when you have a society which is basically a fundamentally run by the church, religious society, you're building in hypocrisy. I mean, that is part of the structure of daily life, essentially.
Right. And one of the interesting things that I point out early on is that the scandalous writer Pietro Aretino, he has written this basically a book in which there's a discussion between two mothers, one of whom is a prostitute, and they're deciding what they should do with the daughter. And they discuss, well, she could be a wife or she could be a nun. And they decide that the most honest thing she could be is a prostitute, given the hypocrisy in society, particularly among the clergy and the upper classes.
Very interesting. So this is just about time to go, but the book is called Habitual Offenders, A True Tale of Nuns, Prostitutes, and Murderers in 17th Century Italy by Craig Monson, who is Professor Emeritus of Music at Washington University. This book is available certainly online, and there's probably other ways that...
It's available all the usual places.
All the usual places.
Yeah, yeah.
And you are working on, we're not going to have time to talk about it now, but you're working on another true history about women who poisoned their husbands in, what is it, 18th century Rome?
No, it's in 17th century Rome. And it's sort of divorce Italian style for women.
Oh my goodness. Well, to be continued. Craig Monson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.